Hi, it's Michael Sinoff with Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called Spike Humor, a go-to business consultant for marketing legend Jay Abraham reveals the 30 minutes that could change your business and your life. Everything in life is constantly changing, but if you don't plan the type of change you want to see, you probably won't like the changes you get. This is also true in business. That's why world-renowned business consultant Spike Humor says in order to plan effective change, you should take 30 minutes to do nothing but examine your business and yourself. But you have to be honest with yourself during those 30 minutes about where you are today, where you'd like to be tomorrow, and all the gaps that exist in between so you can make sure you'll be taking action steps that'll get you exactly where you want to go. This means you'll have access to your goals, passion, vision, and happiness to make sure all your decisions are aligned with your mindset of success. And in this audio, you'll hear how to do that. You'll also learn the four absolute crucial steps Spike takes his clients through to create immediate and lasting success for any business. You'll learn the easy but effective way to keep up with today's economy by changing your USP to a UVP, unique value proposition, and how to use it to turn everyday transactions into relationships for life. You'll learn how to lead from behind in your business and get everyone eager to do their best work. You'll learn the vision of possibility, why it's so important, and how to create it in yourself. You'll learn how understanding the difference between cost, price, and value can be the most important thing you do to increase your margins. You'll learn the true meaning of accountability and how to use it as a stepping stone to success instead of a way to place blame. You'll learn how to raise capital for your business and the one thing you need to make sure you have before you even think about it. You'll learn the one and only time you should think about brand marketing and the only time you should cut marketing in even the worst economy. You'll learn the biggest and probably most common mistake people make when they form a joint venture. You'll learn why Spike tells his clients to have a to-do list along with a don't-do list and exactly what should go on each. According to Spike, the biggest tragedy in life is to work your butt off for 40 years to get to a certain point and then realize it's not what you wanted after all. But that won't happen if you follow the model he outlines in this audio interview. You'll learn how to check in with yourself and your business to make sure you're always on the right track, even if you're not currently in trouble. Now let's get going.
Hi, this is Arthur Robinson, Jr. I teamed up with Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com to bring you the greatest interviews on subject matter you won't find anywhere else. I'd like to welcome Spike Humor to the call.
Thank you. I appreciate the introduction.
What I would like to know, and can you educate my listeners in regards to who you are, how long have you been in your powerful industry, and what is your expertise?
Well, I guess I would kind of sum it up this way. I mean, I've been in business for about 30 years, you know, everything from blue-collar demolition when I was a kid, the whole way up to doing turnaround work for significant corporations, both public and private. But in addition to that, I mean, my focus really has been working with small to mid-sized entrepreneurial business owners and helping them not only achieve what it is that they want to get out of their business, but also helping them make sure that their business and their business activities are in alignment with their personal goals, their personal mission, and their personal vision. And a lot of my work, while I worked in manufacturing companies, and worked in manufacturing industries, I learned a lot about process and process control, how to enhance what was already working. But also, I have been fortunate enough to be interacting with so many industries and so many companies and so many countries around the world. I've also been able to find a lot of the things that were working in one industry or working in one market and really to help business owners develop innovative strategies that they could apply in their industry or their business that perhaps they weren't aware of.
That is very powerful. Can you explain to my listeners in layman's terms, why is this topic so important, surviving in today's economy?
Well, I think, you know, the challenges that business owners and I think the challenges that people face in general are not only greater today, but the rate of change and the variety of change is happening so fast because of technology and because of globalization, because of fluctuations in the economy and uncertainties in the economy. I think that business owners and people in general have to be prepared not to do business just the way they did it yesterday and not just the way they're doing business today, but also how can you predict what you need to be doing tomorrow and the day after that and the year after that? Because if you don't plan the type of change that you want to have in your business, what's going to happen is you're going to be forced to change. And that change that you make, when you make it and how you make it, may not necessarily be the change that you want to make in your business. So I think, you know, by having a strategy, by having a mindset that allows you to be not only aware of what's going on in your business, but also being flexible and adaptable to the things that are necessary to make sure that you not just survive in business, but also that you succeed in business, I think that is the ultimate competitive edge that someone can have in business today.
Can you explain to my listeners, what is your UVP, unique value proposition?
Well, I think many people in business are familiar with the term unique selling proposition. It goes back to Ross Reeves back in the 1950s, and he talked about unique selling proposition as being kind of a slogan that would kind of sum up what it is that your product or your service or your company did so that people would have interest in buying. And I think for 40 years, I think that was phenomenal, and maybe even 50 years. But I think today's economy and I think today's competition requires something that's a lot more distinct than just a unique selling proposition. I think the most powerful thing that you can do is have a unique value proposition, because it's not just about selling. It doesn't matter if you have a product or you have a service or if you're a personality or whatever. It's not just about selling. It's about creating value for your audience. It's about creating value for your marketplace. It's about creating value for your clients and your prospects on an ongoing basis. So I think by summing up what your unique value proposition can be as a business owner or as a company or your product or your service or your combination of things opens up a whole range of possibilities for you to create value and deepen the relationship that you have with your marketplace, your prospects, and your clients.
So once you create powerful value, and once people like you, respect you, and trust you, then that's when their minds are made up when they want to do business with you?
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, you know, for me, it comes down to this, and there's a distinction that I make for many businesses, and that is there's a fine line between marketing and selling, and I think sometimes companies get it wrong because they say sales and marketing like they're one thing. Well, first, they have it backwards. But marketing is really about conveying value, but selling is about earning trust. And the greatest currency that you can have in today's marketplace is trust and relationships, and I'll tell you why. The bottom line is when people go to make a purchase, they go to do business with someone, they're not looking to enter into a transaction. They're looking for a solution. But the bottom line is they don't know if they should trust you, trust your company, trust your product, trust your service. More importantly, they don't even know if they should trust themselves about making the right decision. So the more effectively you can convey value on the front end and the more congruently you can earn that trust, the more quickly a transaction can take place, which ultimately will allow you to create a relationship. And it's the value of that relationship over time that will make your business not only successful today, but successful in the future.
So once you create value, that's when it creates a virtual effect around the whole entire world?
Well, it can. I mean, in many cases, you know, the business transaction that you do on a local basis can really shape a relationship on the other side of the world. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, I'm located in California. You're in Pennsylvania. I had a call this afternoon with a company in Canada. Earlier today, I had a call with a company in Israel. Now, these companies aren't companies that I work with face-to-face. These are companies that I interact with. But in each and every one of these cases, these people were found by me or found me through a relationship that I had with someone else that I did on a local basis or in the course of my travels. So I think even if you're a corner deli and you're doing business on a corner in your hometown, understanding that it's not just competing with the deli around the corner, it's really competing with every other opportunity that people have to spend their money, to spend their time, or to take their attention. That's really where your competition is. And I think the more significantly you can develop a relationship, the more significantly you can not only sustain your business, but also stand out in your industry and stand out in your marketplace.
What is the first physical actions that my listeners can do in order to increase their margins?
Well, the very first thing is to understand the difference between cost, price, and value. Let me explain. Now, every business owner understands the difference between cost and price, right? Whatever it costs you to make something or whatever it costs you to deliver something, that's your cost basis. How much it costs you to perform that service or offer that product. Whatever you sell it for, the difference between those two is your profit margin. But in many cases, it's not just the difference between the cost and price that is most important. It's the difference between the cost, the price, and the value. And let me explain. If you were someone who was in need of a heart valve to be implanted into your chest and it was going to save your life. Now, the cost of that valve may be $1,000. The price of that valve may be $20,000. But the value of that valve to that person who's going to have their life saved, to have their heart saved, could be infinitely valuable. And I think really by being able to articulate the real value that your product or your service or the experience that people have when they do business with you and the value of that relationship in terms of what it means for their life, the challenges that they face, the opportunities that they're pursuing, and ultimately the results and the benefits that they can receive by doing business with you, that's priceless. That's not something that your competitors can match. That's not something your competitors can duplicate. In most cases, it's not something your competitors can ever replace. So by focusing on what it is that you do on a unique value basis and educating your marketplace and educating your prospects to why that has meaning to them, why that has value for them, and why you are uniquely qualified and positioned to deliver that for them, I think gives you a competitive advantage that no one else can match.
So once you basically are thinking outside the box, then basically there is no competition as long as you provide powerful value.
You're absolutely right, but it's also about understanding that value is subjective and value is interpreted differently by people. But if you're able to help educate people in terms of what value means to them and why what you do has value to them, what it means for their life, what it means for their business, what it means in terms of their problems, their challenges, their hopes, their fears, their desires, you can, in many cases, articulate or verbalize things that they're feeling but they may not be aware of. You can educate them to the real true value of what it is that you do and not just the price of the product or service that you do. And I think if you're able to communicate that, you're able to convey that, and you're able to deliver that on a consistent and congruent basis, it allows you to have not only transactional trust, it allows you to have relationship trust.
Who do you have that is in your corner to help you maximize your market?
A lot of people, and I've been very fortunate because I've been able to interact with some very prominent people, including Jay Abraham and people like yourself. You know, many of the people that I think the public would see as, you know, kind of icons in the speaking and consulting industry. But in addition to that, you know, many of my most valuable relationships and many of my most valuable mentors, teachers, and models have been people that I've met through books, people that I've met in going to seminars, people that I've worked with, and people that have worked for me. And I think one of the things that has not only allowed me to grow, but has also assisted me in growing, and that is, you know, is that I look for lessons and look for opportunities to learn from everyone and everything around me. I mean, some of the greatest lessons I've ever learned, I've learned from my children. And it's not because they had more experience in life or business or in many of the areas that I focus on, but yet because of their perspective or because of something that they did or something that they said, it allowed me to learn. So I think having that attitude of being a sponge and having an attitude of having a growth mindset gives you the opportunity to have models and mentors and examples that you can learn regardless of whether the person is world famous or whether that person happens just to be, you know, a profound thinker or a profound doer in whatever field or whatever endeavor they choose.
Would you say, Spike, that powerful, influential leaders are unconventional thinkers?
In many cases, and I'll tell you why. I mean, it's a great question, by the way. You know, leadership requires a couple of things. Number one, it requires the ability to see beyond what is present, because otherwise there's no reason for people to follow you and there's no reason for you to move from where you are. And the very definition of leadership is that you're moving in some direction, right? So if you can't see what's possible, there's no reason for people to follow you. The second is that I think most people who are great leaders understand that leadership is not about themselves being a leader. It's about the people that they're leading. And I think if they can make that distinction, that it's not just about what's in it for them, it's about what's in it for the people who are following them. There's a saying by Lao Tzu that says, if you want to lead people, lead from behind, which means, you know, basically you allow them to go in the direction that's in their best interest and you help support them. And in many cases, you help guide them, you help steer them. In many cases, you help kind of prod them along. And sometimes, you know, leading from behind is one of the most effective things that you can do. But most importantly, you have to have the ability to see something that doesn't yet exist. And you have to have the ability to instill confidence and trust in people. And the way you do that is to understand what's in it for them. You know, one of my very early business mentors shared a lesson with me when I was about 21 years old. It has stayed with me for the rest of my life. And that was, he said, when you're supervising or when you're managing people, never ask someone to do something that serves your values without giving them the opportunity to serve their values in return. And that stayed with me for the rest of my life. And it served me well because it made me understand that people aren't going to do things for my reasons. They're going to do them for their reasons. And if I can help them see how doing something that I want them to do or need them to do will satisfy their values or satisfy their needs or make them better off because of it, they're not doing it because I ask them to do it. They're doing it because it's in their best interest.
This is Arthur Robinson Jr. reporting for Michael Sinoff's ArtDefineSeminar.com. So you have to develop relationship marketing if you're going to be around for longevity reasons.
Well, you do. And I think many businesses, even businesses that focus on one-time transactions, because the reality of it is, you know, in some cases, businesses only do one transaction with a person. But it's not just about the transaction. It's about the relationship, because that transaction that you do with that person one time, they're going to tell their friends. They're going to tell their family. They're going to tell people on social media. They're going to tell people that they interact with and encounter over their lifetime. And that single transaction can transform your business if you look at it as a way to deepen and develop a relationship that allows you to create value, not just on that one-time basis, but on an ongoing basis. It allows you to create referral systems. It allows you to find other products and services that perhaps they may need that you don't supply, so it creates joint venture opportunities. It also creates opportunities for you to collect information that perhaps you can provide them information on other areas that they have interest in, and then perhaps be a source or a supply of that information or that knowledge that they seek. But it's ultimately about that relationship, and if you can create that relationship, you have an asset that may not show up on your balance sheet, but will show up on the scorecard that means your business is being successful. And I think, you know, the philosophy and the concept that I teach, and I think there are other people that teach it as well, and that is, you know, your goal should be to create a relationship for life. Because creating a one-time transaction takes a lot of work. But that same energy, that same effort, with just a little bit more positioning and a little bit more concern and a little bit more education in terms of that relationship, can turn that transaction into a relationship that lasts a long time, if not for life.
You mentioned that powerful word, joint venture marketing. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to my listeners what exactly is joint ventures?
Let me say what it's not. Okay, when I talk about joint ventures, I'm not talking about two mega corporations coming together, putting together millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars together to form another entity where they become a partner in a new entity. And I think when you talk to corporations, they kind of associate joint ventures as that. And I'm also not talking about it the way many of the information marketers or online marketers talk about it, where it's just simply a cross-promotion of a product, you know, to one person's email list and back and forth. I mean, they're both forms of joint ventures. But for sake of discussion, I mean, I consider a joint venture, you know, it could be a strategic alliance, it could be a cross-promotion, it could be almost anything, but really what it is, in its simplest terms, is that it's two or more parties coming together specifically for the purposes of creating value for each other and a third party. And that third party could be a marketplace, that third party could be a community, that third party could be a client of one or more of the other parties, but ultimately it's a way to combine the efforts and assets of two or more parties so that they can create additional value, enhanced value, or sustained value that they may not be able to do on their own.
You just elaborated about strategic alliance. For my listeners that never heard of that powerful term, what exactly is that?
Well, strategic alliance, I mean, it kind of fits into the same definition, but in technical terms, it really means, you know, two businesses or two people coming together saying, look, we're going to pool our common talent or our common resources or our common energies or our common skill set, and we're going to align our efforts in such a way that we're going to create something new and different or do something new and different than we would be doing by ourselves. And I'll give an example. You know, there may be a strategic alliance between a company in Iowa and another company in Texas, because the company in Texas might have clients or relatives of clients in Iowa that they can't serve. So perhaps those two companies come together and they create a strategic alliance so that the people in Iowa have the opportunity to buy the products and services from their partner in Iowa, even though they may not have a physical store, they may not have a physical location, they may not have salespeople there. But yet, even though they may be separate companies, their efforts and their energies and their assets are aligned in such a way that they can create a transaction or create a relationship with a marketplace that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise by themselves.
Can you explain, Spike, in your own powerful words, when did you decide to become a man of value?
That's a great question. I'd like to think that I've thought about that all my life. I don't know that I've ever made that decision. I think my mom kind of guided me in that direction. And when I say guided, it wasn't a subtle guiding. It was like, get up off your butt, go do something and make something happen, buddy. And not quite so politely. But I think ultimately, I think I realized at a very early age that I couldn't do everything that I wanted in life by myself. And even if I could, I'm not sure that I wanted to, because it didn't have the same level of meaning, the same level of juice, or the same level of passion as if I could do something and I could do it with other people or do something that would create value for other people. So I don't know that it was something that I ever made a decision, you know, to do, but I think it was something that was instilled in me, you know, because of my background and my upbringing and the people that I was exposed to growing up. And the people that I met that were most successful and the people that I admired most were people that did things not just for themselves, but they did things for other people. And when I say did things for people, wasn't necessarily that they gave the most money or they were the most charitable, but what they did is that they found a way to impact the lives and businesses and relationships of the people that they came in contact with. And many of those people created that value for me. And because of that, I always wanted to return that and find ways that I could share that with other people as well.
Did you have mentor Spike to help you build your phenomenal brand?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have mentors to this day. Some of them I've never met. You know, some of my mentors are people that I've read throughout history and I've used as models and I've used as teachers in terms of, you know, their lives and their work and their teachings. But I've had, you know, a half a dozen mentors on a formal basis in my life in business where, you know, everything from the guy who gave me the lesson in leadership to a couple of other people that kind of put their arm around me and said, here, pay attention, kid, let me show you something. You might see something that you never thought about. But at the same time, I've also had the opportunity to mentor other people. And one of the things that was instilled in me through my mentors is that it really was one of those pay it forward type things, that if I'm going to offer you my wisdom, my insight, my experience, and the benefit of what it is that I've learned over life, I'm going to expect you to do the same for someone else in return. So as I got older and as I became more successful in business, or as I became more knowledgeable in certain areas, it was almost not just an obligation, but it was really a vow in return to the people who were so contributing and so significant to me to do the same thing for other people.
And can you name maybe two of your mentors that you really look up to?
I could, but I'm not sure that anyone would know him. I mean, there was a gentleman, and his name was Joe Coria. He was a plant manager for a company that I worked for, and I wanted to be a plant manager. And he taught me a lot about people. He taught me a lot about business. And he wasn't even someone who had a business degree, but he understood people, and he understood leadership, and he understood how to make things happen. And he was someone that had a profound impact on my professional career. On a personal level, you know, probably my greatest mentor is my mother. I mean, you know, she was a single mom, and we lived in tough neighborhoods, and she had a tough life. But yet every single day, you know, she got up, and she did what it took to take care of the family, and she was the toughest, strongest, most loving person I ever met in my life. And while that was a life mentor, it also carried over into business. And some of my greatest lessons just came through interactions with my mother, not necessarily the things that she said, and sometimes not even the things that she did, but just the things that I observed in terms of who she was and how she conducted herself.
And where are you originally from, Spike?
I grew up in York, Pennsylvania.
2 hours away from me?
Yeah, not very far.
And how old are you now?
I'm 51 years old.
Why should my listeners listen to you? I mean, what makes you different from the other gurus that are teaching powerful business principles?
Well, the first thing I would say is this, because I don't consider myself a guru. That's why, you know, I think people should listen to me. And the reason they should listen to me is not for my reasons, it's for their own reasons. I mean, the bottom line is there's going to be certain things that I say and certain things that I do and certain things that I teach that will have meaning for certain people. And if that's something that resonates with them, you know, by all means, you know, hopefully they learn something from it. For some other people, it may not be something that resonates, which is certainly okay, because I don't think that anyone can be all things to all people. But most importantly, I guess I would sum it up in this philosophy, and that is, you know, when I speak, when I work with a client one-on-one, when I do group mentoring, I understand that what I'm doing is not about me. You know, when I'm standing up on stage, it's never about trying to teach people about how great I am, because if I do that, then basically what I'm doing is providing entertainment. What my goal is, and what it's always been, is to teach people how great they can become. Now, it's not just because of me, it's not just because of my teachings, it's not just because of my learnings, it's because of all the experiences and all the resources that they have within themselves, and the sense of curiosity and the sense of possibility that they bring to the event, and the actions that they take as a result of those experiences and their own motivations, their own drives, and their own dreams that will create the results that are necessary for them to have their own greatness. I just happen to be part of the process. And I think in this industry, I think many people mistake the fact that, you know, they have a great message and they think that because they have a great message that they're the ultimate messenger. And ultimately, it's not about the person sending the message, it's about the person receiving the message. And I think if people keep that in mind, not only do they contribute more to the audience, but they also give people more freedom, but also more responsibility and more accountability to implement the information for their own success.
You're listening to an interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
How would you define accountability?
Well, accountability to me is, you know, bottom line, you know, is that you set a goal, you set a strategy around that goal, you set certain activities that are going to go into implementing those strategies, and you set certain timelines around those things. And accountability is, are you doing the things that you're committed to doing? And are you doing the things consistently that you're committed to doing? Are you doing the things not only consistently, but consistently well that you're committed to doing? And if the answer is no, there's generally comes down to two things. Number one, either you're really not committed, or number two, you really don't know how, or perhaps you don't know the best way or the right way. And by examining those two questions, sometimes you change the goal, and other times you change the approach. But accountability really comes down to, are you doing the things that you're absolutely committed to? Are you your actions and your behaviors and your beliefs and how you spend your time and the activities that you undertake aligned with what it is that you think you need to do in order to be successful in those areas. And if the answer is yes, then you're being accountable to yourself, you're being accountable to your dreams. You know, unfortunately, I think a lot of times people look at accountability as a way to place blame. You know, they say, well, you know what, I'm going to hold you accountable, so therefore I'm going to blame you. Blame and accountability are two separate things. Blame is essentially trying to diminish someone or make someone feel guilty by using hindsight and saying, you know, you could have, would have, should have did this. Accountability is, you know, let's sit down here and examine what we thought we were going to do and the results we thought we were going to achieve, and let's find out why we didn't have it. You know, did we not have the right strategy? Did we not have the right resources? Did we have the wrong goal? Did we overestimate, you know, the resources that we had? Did we underestimate the challenge? And if the answers can be asked in that way, you still can remain accountable, you still can remain responsible, but you also can remain flexible in terms of going out and trying again to do the things that you're really truly committed to doing. And to me, that's accountability.
What would be your business model now, Spike, in today's economy?
Well, my personal business model or my advice on creating a business model?
Your personal business model.
Well, my personal business model really is engaging people in a variety of ways and conveying knowledge, expertise, and value in helping them achieve really what it is that's important to them. And I do that through public seminars. I mean, I speak for large groups around the world. I have small group seminars of a couple hundred people. I also have mastermind groups. I have group mentoring programs that I work with. And I also have some clients that I work with on a one-to-one basis. In addition to that, I have products and services, and I have a book that I, you know, just share information, share knowledge, share a perspective, and hopefully share some effective strategies with people that allow them not to do what it is that I think they should do, but help them to discover what it is that they really truly want to do and help them formulate strategies to make that happen.
I know that you are the co-presenter with the legendary marketing guru, Jay Abraham. Can you explain to my listeners, how did that relationship all come about?
Like a lot of people, I was a student of Jay's work going back about 25 years. In fact, a lot of the things that I learned about marketing, I learned through Jay's books along with some of the other marketing greats over the years. And I had followed Jay's work for about 10 years, maybe 12 years. And about another 12 years or so ago, I decided to call him up on the phone one day. And it was actually quite easy to get a hold of him. And I'll share that story with you another time. But the bottom line is, you know, I was someone that was inspired by many of the things that he learned, that he then translated and turned into his own work and then taught his own lessons and created his own programs. And he taught businesses really how to market in ways that most people weren't learning about in college and most people weren't figuring out on their own. You know, Jay had come from the direct response marketing industry, so he knew a lot of the strategies that could be applied to traditional businesses that they really weren't aware of. And I learned a lot of those strategies from Jay. So over the years, you know, I became not only a fan of his work and a student of his work, but I became a friend of his and also became a client of his. I became his client because he hired me as a consultant, and we worked together in a variety of capacities in a variety of ways for the better part of 10 years on and off.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about value, so basically you were adding value to Jay Abraham. In addition to that, he was already adding value to you, even though he didn't know it yet.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think one of the opportunities that people have when they start thinking about the unique value proposition, and that is to understand that no matter how successful someone is, no matter how skilled someone is in a particular area, there's also another area or other areas of their lives or their business that they're not quite as skilled. In my background, because of a lot of my management background and a lot of my turnaround skill sets and experiences that I had in working with distressed companies were skill sets that Jay didn't have. And then, you know, of course, Jay being, you know, Jay Abraham and the marketing person that he is, he had, you know, a lot of marketing skills that I hadn't yet possessed. And so I think, you know, in working together, not only at his company and also in ventures that we had together, but also at his programs, you know, I was able to bring certain things to the audience that perhaps Jay didn't experience, like, you know, running larger companies and doing turnarounds and distressed companies and doing consultative selling and some of those things. And Jay, of course, being Jay, was able to bring a lot of the marketing message that he really possessed in a very unique way to the marketplace and allowed him to focus on the things that he did best and allowed me to do the things that I could do best. And because of that, the events, I think, took on a new meaning and took on a new dimension and really allowed us to deliver value in a way that neither one of us would have been able to do by ourselves.
You mentioned a distressed company. Can you give me an example of a distressed company?
Well, I think a distressed company, there's a range of it. The first one is a company that's not living up to its potential. Now, it may not necessarily be to the point where it's going to collapse, but if it's not living up to its potential, there's an element of distress there. You know, the next area would be, you know, a company that's stagnated, where basically they've kind of capped out their growth and they've kind of gotten to the point where they're just not moving forward anymore. That's a point of distress. The next would be, you know, a company that's struggling. where, you know, it's having challenges and it's not making money, or it's not making the money that it should be making, or they have a very uncertain future. The next level of the distress is where, you know, a company is actually declining, where it's going downhill and perhaps it's starting to lose money. And then, of course, another point of distress is where a company really is at a point where they just can't continue to go on and expect to survive unless they make drastic and significant changes. And I think when people hear the word turnaround and doing turnarounds, they think of those companies that are on the verge of going out of business. And I've worked with many of those companies where I got the call in the middle of the night saying, you know what, I can't make payroll and I need you here tomorrow morning to help me figure this out because I may not be able to survive the month. But ultimately, to me, you know, a turnaround really needs to be broader than that. And a turnaround can be a company that says, you know what, I'm doing pretty well. And in fact, you know, I think, you know, my future is still pretty bright. But yet at the same time, I want to go back and I want to examine my business so that I can make changes today that will allow me to have a better business or to ensure my future in a way that I might not otherwise be able to do because I haven't taken the time to examine my business. If you take the term turnaround and you almost transpose that with transformation, the process that I take businesses through isn't just, you know, doing a turnaround because the company's at a point of desperation, but also helping a company transform their thinking, their direction, or just reexamining their beliefs and their practices to validate the fact that the way they're doing business is the best way for them today, tomorrow, and the year after that.
Having a powerful mindset, you need to inherit that if you want to build a successful company making 10 figures or more.
I think mindset is ultimately, you know, one of the key elements. You know, mindset is critical. I mean, if you don't believe that it can happen, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult to happen unless you have people around you who believe they can make it happen. The second is if you don't have the mindset that has a vision of possibility or a vision of something else, it's very difficult to move from where you are because you think that's really all there is because that's all you can see. But I think it goes beyond mindset. I mean, I think mindset, first and foremost, is key because one of the elements of mindset that makes that possible is the sense of clarity, the sense of certainty, the sense of confidence and congruency and consistency in making the right decisions for the right reasons at the right time in the right way. But on top of that, I think it really comes down to aligning the actions that you take and making sure that the actions and the decisions that you make are consistent with that mindset and with that vision of possibility that you have. Because if you don't have those two things aligned, you may have great hopes for the future, but if you have a bad strategy, you can be very, very efficient and very, very effective at going in the wrong direction. So I think you have to have, you know, not only a mindset that has clarity, but you also have to have a consistency in your actions. Now, along with that, I think you also have to have the ability that you can evaluate where you're going on a regular basis. Because if you think of a rocket when it's sitting on the launching pad, and if its trajectory is off just 2 inches, 2 inches doesn't seem like a lot. But as that rocket starts to go up and it's 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles or 10,000 miles, that trajectory and that margin of error that we started off as 2 inches becomes tens of thousands of miles because it wasn't course corrected and it wasn't realigned and it wasn't measured as it went. So the time to make those corrections, the time to make those changes is right now, and to make them on a regular basis as opposed to waiting until 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road when you find that you're so far off from your original vision or your original goals or your original business model that you just find that the business that you have is not the business that you wanted.
So your vision leads to a powerful decision.
I think it can, and I think it should, but it doesn't always. You know, I think sometimes people have a vision, but they don't make a decision on how they're going to pursue that vision. You know, it's called stagnation. You know, sometimes people have a vision of where they want to be, but they haven't really detailed or really haven't outlined a strategy or the steps that are necessary in order to make that vision happen. And I'll give you an example. If you ask the average person on the street who's not making any money or making very little money, and you said, would you like to be a millionaire? Most people will say, you know what, I do. I have great desire. And if you said to them, you know, can you see yourself being a millionaire? Some percentage of those people would say yes. Many people would say, no, I just couldn't see that happening for me. But even the people that had the vision that it's possible, if they didn't have a good strategy or if they didn't have good systems or they didn't have good structures or they didn't have, you know, the right models or mentors in place to help them get there, their chances of succeeding or their chances of making that happen are very, very small. So it's not just the mindset and it's not just the decision. It's really about having an effective strategy and a system that helps you get there. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think mentors and mentoring programs, seminars, consultants, advisors, whether it be a board of advisors or whether it be what I call, you know, the kitchen table advisors, the people that come over to your house on the weekend when you have a barbecue, they give you feedback and advice. I think having advisors, you know, is one of the key elements of being successful, even for some of the most successful people in the world. I mean, you look at Bill Gates. I mean, you know, one of his advisors is Warren Buffett. Now, you know, those two guys are probably the two most successful people of our generation, if not in the history of the world, but they have mentors and they have models and they have people that they consider as advisors and people who are their contemporary colleagues that help guide them and help them make decisions as well.
For more great interviews like this, go to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
This is very, very, very powerful information that you share with me and the listeners in regards to business principles and adding value to your clients and customers. How can my listeners best position themselves to overcome today's challenges and take advantage of tomorrow's opportunities?
The first thing that I would say is that you have to kind of sit down and assess where you are today. If you don't know exactly where you are today, and if you're not facing the realities of today, it's very, very difficult to make the changes that are necessary. If you're not standing on solid ground or have a solid understanding of where you are, being able to shift from that is like trying to make a football cut in sand. It's kind of hard to get traction. So I think the very first thing is to sit down and have an honest conversation with yourself or the people that are in your life or the people that are in your business and say, okay, where are we really at this moment in our business and where is it that we really want to be? And identify those gaps that exist between where you are today and where it is that you want to go. From that, you formulate a strategy or a number of strategies that you think will help bridge those gaps based on the resources that you have, the experiences that you have, the relationships that you have, and recognizing the challenges that you have, because you may not have all the resources or you may not have all the experiences that are necessary for you to accomplish that strategy. Then you figure out what action steps that you can take, you know, to make sure that, you know, you're doing what's necessary on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and yearly basis to make sure that strategy is coming to fruition. But most importantly, and I think this is the one that most people miss, and I think is probably most vital going forward, and that is, do you have the ability to adjust and adapt and the flexibility that's necessary for you to make the changes that have to be made when they need to be made based on changes in the economy, changes in your industry, changes with the competition, changes inside of your organization? And having that flexibility and having that adaptability is the key not only to survival today, it's also the key to success for tomorrow.
What makes you unique from your competitors in today's economy?
When I say this, hopefully this comes across as being candid and not being arrogant. I don't believe I have competitors, and I'll tell you why. Because what I do is unique to me based on my experiences and based on, you know, my knowledge and my models and my mentors and my methods and my mistakes, you know, that I've made along the way. And I think, you know, while there are other people that operate in the speaking business and there are other people that operate in the consulting business, I think their unique skill sets make them unique. So I don't consider them my competition. Now, we may compete for business, and we may compete for dollars, and we may compete for attention, we may compete for credibility, but I really don't see myself as having competitors, because if I'm being true to myself and I'm being true to the value proposition that I believe that I bring to the table, it's really unique. And it's not because I'm better or not because, you know, I'm the best, but because the combination of skill sets that I have and the combination of experiences that I have serve me uniquely and help me serve my clients uniquely, just as it does for anyone else in this industry or any other business.
So basically, happy customers can be loyal customers, and they can keep coming to you wanting your product or your service?
In many cases, yes. There's an expression or an adage, I think, that most people know, that the customer is always right. And I believe that. And some people say, well, they can't always be right. Well, they are always right, but sometimes they're not right for you. Sometimes they're right for somebody else. And what I mean by that is that, you know, there's certain things. If someone came to me and said, you know, I want you to teach me how to be an NBA basketball player. I'm going to hire you as a consultant. I want you to give me a great strategy. I want you to give me a great workout program, and I want you to make sure that I do it every single day. And you know what I would tell them? Ain't going to happen, baby, because I can't shoot a basketball for a lick. So I'm going to help them find somebody else. And in helping them find somebody else, I still create value for that person, even though it's not me delivering it directly. So I think, you know, it's not just about, you know, knowing or thinking that you can do everything for everyone, but in many cases, you can't do everything. But one of the philosophies and one of the principles that I try to operate in, and that is, even if I can't say yes to someone, you know, meaning that I say yes to them as a client or I say yes to a request that they make, I still want to give them value in some way. There was someone that wanted to engage me for a consultation a few days ago, and for whatever reason, their partner decided that they didn't want to spend the money or just wasn't a good fit, which, you know, is certainly their right and certainly they were entitled to do. And one of the things that I said, that, you know, that's certainly fine with me, I understand. And I said, but I always like to leave people with value. So let me give you three strategies that I think that you can implement on your own right away, starting today, that I think will make a difference in your business. Now, I did that not as a way to re-solicit them or try to convince them otherwise to come back and do the consultation, because it was a two-hour consultation. It wasn't going to change my life or my business. But what happened is that 2 days later, they came back and said, you know what, we did that. We tried that. It made a difference, and we want to hire you right away. Now, again, it's a two-hour consultation. It's not going to change my life. And had they done it or had they not, my goal was to leave them with value so that they had an opportunity to at least have a relationship and a transaction with me. They said, you know what, this guy gave me value. He cared about me. He cared about my business, and he helped me do something.
I always encourage my listeners to create their own loop. And loop basically stands for leverage off of people. What would be your definition of leverage?
to go back to the Archimedes point where, you know, give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum and I can move the world. But the thing that most people miss is that he also says, give me a place to stand. And in order to have leverage, you have to have a solid foundation, and that foundation has to be an understanding of what it is that you want to do, what it is you're willing to do, what it is you're willing to give up, and what it is that you're willing to do for other people. And if you can do those things, you can find leverage, because ultimately leverage is about getting more through a certain activity because you're more effective, you're more efficient, you have more people, you have more resources, you're more strategic, you're wiser, you're brighter, you're smarter, you're more creative. But doing things in such a way that by doing that same activity one way, you're going to get a much greater result than you would if you do it a different way. That's leverage. And I think people and relationships are one of the greatest leverages that you can have, provided you utilize those relationships in such a way that it's ethical, it's honest, and it's contributory to all parties involved. It's not self-serving, and it's not one-sided. Because I think those types of relationships or those types of leverages are negative leverage. I mean, because you can actually be doing something that's causing you damage in a very effective, very efficient manner because you're doing something that is deemed as self-serving, dishonest, unethical, or inappropriate for someone else. And you certainly can get a result, and you'll get that result much faster, even though that result may be negative. So leverage can be positive or negative. It depends on where you stand and how you're actually, you know, using your lever.
Can you express to my listeners, with your powerful insight, how can they raise capital for their business?
You know, there's a lot of ways to do it, but I'll give you something that's a little bit outside your question, and that is, before you want to raise capital, you have to think about what is it that you would do if you had that capital, and I'll tell you why. Because if you go to someone and you say, you know what, I need money, but you don't have a good reason, or you don't have a good plan, or you don't have a good strategy of how you're going to utilize that, almost anyone, even a long-lost relative who has lots and lots of money, is probably going to say no, because they're going to say, you know what, you really don't know what you're going to do with it. But the other reason why it's so important to know what it is that you would do with that money, because in many cases, you can still get access to the things that you need without using capital. I mean, let me give you an example. Say, for instance, one of the things that you wanted to do was to expand your listening audience. Now, you could say, okay, well, I could advertise. You know, I could buy more radio time. You know, I could go to other radio stations. But ultimately, if you found someone who had access to the marketplace that you were trying to reach and found a way to do a strategic alliance, do a joint venture, or do a cross-promotion with that person so that it benefited not only you, but it benefited them and it benefited their audience as well, now all of a sudden you could have the same result and get the same transaction or the same audience without having to spend capital to do it. Everyone needs money in business. You know, it's just a fact of life. I mean, that's part of what makes it a business. You know, it's a commercial interaction and a commercial entity. But in many cases, you know, you can utilize things like barter. You can utilize things like referrals or cross promotions, or in some cases, shared revenue activities that can result by having someone introduce you to a marketplace or to an audience that you wouldn't have otherwise have access to, or would have to pay in order to get access to. So there's lots and lots of ways to do it. The bottom line is capital markets today are different than what they were, you know, 3 and 4 years ago. 5 years ago, if you wanted to get a loan for a house, you know, you could go almost anywhere and get it under almost any circumstance. Today, it's a lot more difficult. And for businesses, it's even more difficult because the economy is so uncertain. But if you're looking for capital, the first thing that you do is that you have a solid plan of deployment of that capital in terms of what you're going to do, the strategies that you're going to utilize, you know, to make sure that the deployment is having a positive return. But ultimately, and I think most bankers and most investors and most capital market people will tell you that you have to have a good system of measurement to make sure that you're getting the results that you expect so that you don't get to the end of the capital and find out you made the wrong decision.
Would you agree that when business owners ask for capital, the bottom line is investors want to know how they want to make money on their own money in regards to them advancing you money?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, otherwise it's not an investment, then it's a gift. If you go to someone and say, you know, can you give me some money? I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay you back, or if I will pay you back, or how I'm going to pay you back, you know, and they give you the money, they're giving it to you as a gift. They're not giving it to you as an investment. If you go to someone and you say, I'd like you to give me some money, and what I'm going to do is give you a 10% return or a 20% return on this money, and here's how I'm going to protect your interest, and if it doesn't happen, here's what you're going to get instead, because I'm going to make sure that I have a vested interest in your success as well, now you have a chance and a prospect or a possibility that someone's going to say yes. But at the same time, if they're a savvy investor, they're going to want to make sure that you have a well-thought-out plan, that you have a well-thought-out infrastructure in terms of how you're going to deploy the capital and how you're going to get the results that you expect. And ultimately, you know, how you're going to measure performance so that they can get their money back in a reasonable period of time, or at least in the time frame that you agree to.
This is Arthur Robinson, Jr., reporting for Michael Sinoff's ArtDefineSeminar.com.
So would it be to the business owner's best interest to write up a proposal and show the investors in depth how they're going to get their capital back?
Yeah, in fact, I would even say that there's another reason to do it even before that, and that is if you don't know it, you can't do it for yourself. While you may be playing on other people's money, ultimately you have more at stake because it's your business, your reputation, you know, your relationships and everything else that are being invested into this as well. And so I think even if you wouldn't do it for an investor, even if you're not looking to seek capital, you know, to have a well-reasoned, well-written, well-thought-out, and well-positioned business plan is vital. Now, it doesn't have to be 15 pages thick, and it doesn't have to be something that you do once and you stick in the bottom of your desk drawer and you never look at it again. It should be something that you pull out periodically and just re-examine. What is the mission for your business? What is the vision that you have for your business over time? What are the values that you have, not only for your business, but also for yourself? And ultimately, you know, what are the things, the actions and the activities that you're going to undertake on a week-by-week, quarter-by-quarter, year-by-year basis that's going to make that mission be embraced and engaged over time, make that vision come true over a period of 3 to 5 years, and make sure that your values that you hold personally and that your business holds personally are being fulfilled through the activities that you have in your business. And if you can't do that, or you don't do that at least periodically, chances are at some point in time you're going to get off track and not realize where you got off track, which makes it more difficult to get back on track, by the way.
What is your philosophy on angel investors?
Well, I don't know that I have a philosophy on that. I can tell you my experience. You know, if someone is particularly passionate about you or about your work or about your message or about your cause, you know, in some cases you can find people that are very, very generous and very, very giving in terms of supporting that passion or that mission, that vision, or you or your work. I think a lot of times people focus too much time and energy on trying to find benefactors rather than trying to do the things that are necessary to actually build a business. It would be great if we all had a long-lost uncle that showed up magically and said, you know what, I had $10 million and I was wondering what to do with it, and I'd just love to give it to you so you can go out and do something with it. But the reality of it is it doesn't happen very often. So unless you have a really, really well-thought-out mission and vision and you can find people that really, truly appeals to, it's difficult to find angel investors. I mean, because really what they are is that they're benefactors. And it happens, but it's not something that I would make my business dependent upon, because the chances of it happening for most people is very, very small.
And I love benefactors. And to my listeners on this call, if you've never heard of a benefactor, that basically means a man or a woman who does good for others. Is that correct, Spike?
Yeah, it is. And in those others, in some cases, assume that you would be one of those others. You know, I think we're all benefactors, you know, to some degree. But financial benefactors, you know, are people that very often are angel investors. And they're people that they say, you know what, you have a great mission here. You have a great vision here. And I'm not quite sure how you're going to do it, but I'm willing to put some money into your business and try to help you along, and maybe even give you some guidance. Not so much because I expect I'm going to get a huge return, but because I'm really passionate about you, your work, or what it is that you do. And that's a little bit different than a venture capitalist. And, you know, while there are places in the business world for both, and both of them can be very, very valuable if they're found and if they're utilized right, you know, the best thing that any business owner can do, in my opinion, is to utilize the resources that they have in front of them now to the best of their ability and to the greatest leverage and the greatest potential possible. And then it makes it much easier that if you come across an angel investor, a benefactor, or a venture capitalist, or even a private investor or a banker, it makes it much easier for them to get engaged because they know that you know what you're doing.
When you work with a business, what is your core approach to helping them create immediate and lasting success?
It's really very simple, and it's a proprietary term that I use, and the term is ASIA, A-S-I-A, and I'll tell you exactly what that means. It's an acronym. The very first thing that I do when I go into a business where I work with a client on an individual basis, even people that go to my programs, they go through this, is that we do an assessment. And the assessment is, okay, where are you now? Where do you want to go? And what are the gaps that exist between the two? That's the A in Asia. The next is we say, okay, what possible strategies could be employed to help you bridge the gaps to get you from where you are today to where you want to be tomorrow or whatever period of time you want to get there? And from that, you know, we take the S, you know, in Asia, which is the strategy. We figure out which one is the most practical, probable, or attractive based on what it is that we have to work with in terms of our resources and the opportunities in front of us, the experiences that we have, the relationships we have access to. And then we move into the I phase of Asia, which is the implementation. What tactics are necessary to start implementing that strategy, not 6 months from now, not 6 weeks from now, but starting today? What action can we take starting today, and what action will we take tomorrow and next week and next month to make sure that strategy is being implemented and fulfilled over time? And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, the most important one is the adjustment. And that is, you know, what systems are we going to have in place to make sure that we're recognizing, are we on track or are we off track? Are we doing the things that we need to be doing? And are the things that we're doing that we thought were the right things, are they giving us the right results? And if not, what adjustments can can we make, when do we need to make them, who's going to make them, how are they going to be made, and how are we going to measure it from that point forward to make sure that it's better and not just the same or worse than what we were doing before. And it's really just a four-step model that I take people through, and I do it for personal performance, I do it for business performance, I do it for organizations for strategic planning, I do it in personal consultations. And even the book that I wrote utilizes that framework and that structure, because it came from when I was working with distressed companies. In many cases, I had a very, very short window to get a handle on the business. We had to figure out what was going on in a hurry. We had to figure out a strategy to make changes pretty dramatically and pretty drastically. We had to come up with actions that we could take immediately, and then we had to make sure that we were doing the right things over time to make sure that what we thought was going to work was actually working the way that we thought we were going to be able to do that. And I think any business, and really any type of transformation, change, or adjustments that you want to make in your life or your business really operates well within that frame, because it gives you something that you can not only understand, it also gives you something that you can see, something you can measure, and allows you to make sure that it's consistent with what it is that you want to do. I mean, to me, one of the great tragedies in business, really in life, is to have a business owner who spends 20, 30, 40 years and spends, you know, 60, 80, 100 hours a week trying to get a certain result, and they find out that when they finally get their business to that point, that that's not really what they wanted, and it's not really the reason why they started the business, and what they have is not what they want as a business, but yet they spend most of their life and they almost kill themselves getting there. And I think by using that four-stage model allows people to make that assessment, not just when they're in trouble, but at any time, at any point in their life or any point in time in their business, they can pull that out, go through this process, and say, you know what, yeah, I'm doing things that I wanted to do. I'm doing things exactly the way that I should be doing it. I'm doing it the way that I want to be doing it. But if not, I can make the changes that I want to, the way I want to, when I want to, as opposed to when I'm forced to do it.
Earlier, you mentioned marketing, and I know marketing is very powerful. So would you say that marketing done right is the quickest path to the sale?
I would say it's one of the quickest paths. I'll give it a path that I think would be even faster, and that is a referral. Now, some people go that, you know, referrals are actually marketing, but the bottom line is, if you own a gym and I say, you know what, hey, I'm going to bring my training partner with me, that's the most effective way to grow a business. If you can find a bunch of people to bring their buddies and bring their friends and bring people who have similar interests and they come to your gym instead of somebody else's, that's the quickest way to grow your business. Now, I would say that marketing is vital, and especially in tough times, you know, the tendency, I think, for many businesses, you know, is to cut back their marketing as soon as money gets tight or as soon as, you know, business starts to slow down. They say, you know, I have to cut my marketing budget, which is the exact wrong thing to do, because ultimately, marketing is either an expense or it's an investment. It's not the activity that determines whether it's an expense or an investment. It's the result. You know, bad marketing is always too expensive. Great marketing is never too expensive. And the way you judge your marketing is the results that you get. So, for instance, if I gave you a dollar today and you were able to put an ad in the newspaper and it generated $10, and every time you put a dollar in there, you got $10 back, how much money would you spend? Well, you'd spend as much as you could for as many dollars as you could for as long as it worked. But at the same time, if you spent $10 on an ad and every day you spent those $10, you got a dollar back in business, how long would you do it? Well, you'd probably do it until you either wised up, woke up, or got broke. You know, so it's not the marketing. You know, it's not the activity. It's the effectiveness of it that determines whether it's an expense or an investment.
What would be your general insight about branding?
That's a broad question. I think brands are great, and I think brands can be very, very effective. But I will say, in the traditional sense of brand marketing, it's very ineffective, because it's difficult if you're a product, you want to do brand marketing, say like Coca-Cola, to become a brand unless you have a lot of money and a lot of deep pockets. Now, with that being said, I think with the internet and with social media and with information marketing, you can become your own brand, provided you can define not only what you do and how you do it, but who you do it for. And, you know, it used to be that, you know, you had mass marketing, and then, you know, you went to niche marketing, and then, you know, it became sub-niches, and then nano-niches, and it got really, really small niches. But now, you know, I think marketing so much is about not just product, not just price, not just service like it used to be, and then it moved to experience marketing like, you know, Starbucks and Nordstrom's and things like that, where people wanted to have a unique experience. It really comes down now to identity marketing, and that is, if people can identify you, identify your product, or identify your service as something that they can relate to, and something that they can engage, and something that they can embrace, or someone they can embrace, you can create a brand very, very effectively and very, very inexpensively. But it comes down to really being clear about who you are, what you do, what you deliver, and who you're delivering it for.
Modern technology is very powerful right now. Would you agree with that, Spike?
Well, yeah, otherwise it wouldn't be modern, it'd be obsolete. And I say that not to be sarcastic, but technology has transformed not only, you know, what we do today, but it's transforming everything we'll do tomorrow. And it's transforming at such a rate that there's no one person that can be an expert in everything. And I think because of that, you know, it's even more important to understand what it is that you do really, really well in your business, and what it is you do really, really well in your life, and what it is you do really, really well as a person, find people who do the things that you don't do so well, and let experts be experts doing what they do. You know, I think it's the people that try to be experts in all things and try to be marginal at everything that ultimately become obsoleted because things are just moving way, way too fast. When I first got online and I first got involved in teaching businesses how to market online, the rate of information and the rate of tools that were out there and opportunities that were available, it was relatively slow. So I could give the same company five strategies, and then 2 months later I could give another company those same five strategies, and they worked, you know, for months. Now, you know, by the time, you know, I give companies a strategy of utilizing four, five, or six tools, by the time I go to the next company 2 weeks later, there's five or six other tools that are in the same niche as those same tools, and I have to figure out which ones are the best ones. So, you know, I don't try to be all things to all people, and I don't think any business owner should try to be all things to their business. I think they should find what it is that they do best, figure out how they can spend most of their time doing what it is that they either love the most, that has the greatest impact on their business, or the thing that they do better than anyone else around them, and then find other people to supplement or to do the things that either they can't do, don't want to do, or really don't do all that well.
You're listening to an interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminar.com.
So it's good to delegate things out to other people that you're not good at.
Yeah, you know, I mean, because, you know, the bottom line is, and I was using the analogy earlier of basketball, I'm a terrible basketball player. And if I wanted to be a basketball player, I would figure the one thing that I did best, which is probably rebound or pass, and I would pass it to somebody who could shoot. That's not to say that you shouldn't try to get better at things. You know, the bottom line is the time to get better is not when you're in the game. The time to get better is when you're practicing. And if you're already in business, trying to get better at, you know, accounting when you're a great salesperson, or trying to get better at marketing when you're a great manager or a great recruiter, you know, sometimes it's better and cheaper and easier and more effective to find someone else who's already good at that and allow you to become extraordinary at what you do. I'll give you an example. You know, a company brought me in a number of years ago, and the CEO was someone who was really, really successful, and the company was doing really well. I mean, they didn't need me to do performance changes. What he needed was me to come in and help him get situated and organized in terms of, you know, how he could get control of his life and his business back from a personal standpoint. And one of the things that I asked him is that, what is it that you do better than anyone else in the business? What is it that when you do it, it has the biggest impact on your business? And what is it that you're most passionate about in your business? And he said, you know, the thing that I really, really loved the most and the thing that I really missed the most was that I miss interacting with the people. When I had, you know, 30 people or 40 people, I was able to go around every day and say good morning to people. I knew their names, I knew their birthdays, I knew the names of their children. And as the business got bigger, I spent less time doing that. And now, you know, people come up to me and they say, I really miss the days when we had a chance just to talk. And one of the things that, you know, he really wanted to get back to was connecting with the people. And not only was it important to him, it also had a dramatic impact on the business, because when he actually took time and he actually had time in his calendar when he went out and he interacted with people, the productivity in his business actually went up, because people were actually working not just for themselves, they were working for the relationship that they had with him. So what we did is we had his assistant follow him around literally for 2 weeks and write down every single thing that he did through the course of the day to figure out what we could allocate, what we could delegate, and what we could eliminate so that he could spend more time doing that. Now, he still had other things he had to do, and he didn't spend all his time going around chit-chatting, but at the same time, he had a couple of hours every single day that he went out and interacted with the people in his business. It made him feel better. It was something that only he could do, and it was something that had a strategic benefit for his business. And the accounting things and some of the other things that he was doing were very easily allocated to someone else. And it was effective. And it seems very simple after the fact, but sometimes when you're up to your ears in alligators, it's kind of hard to see the light. And in that situation, he was trying to juggle so many things and trying to do everything he thought was necessary. He wasn't doing the things that were best for him or the best for the business. Even though he was still successful, he wasn't happy and he wasn't getting the level of success that he deserved or the level of success that he wanted.
What other skills and areas of knowledge are essential for success in business?
I would say, you know, flexibility and adaptability, which I mentioned, being able to understand your unique value, which I think is critical. But I think also, you know, recognizing that there just are certain things that you just can't do, shouldn't do, or shouldn't be doing very long. And I'll give an example. I can do accounting, but I hate it. And when I do it, it works on my nerves. I can tell you that, you know, I'm not the handiest guy in the world, but I know how to use a hammer, I know how to use a screwdriver, I know how to use a drill, but I don't like doing handiwork. You know, so I know that when I do that, it irritates me, it irritates my wife because I get irritated, so it's much better, it's much more effective for me in my life and my business for me to do the things that I want to do and get somebody else to do those things. And I think by recognizing the things that you shouldn't be doing, that can make you more effective. I mean, people often talk about having a to-do list. I tell people you also should have a to-don't list. What are the the things that you're not going to do or that you shouldn't be doing because it's taking you away from the things that you should be doing. And I think that's a critical skill. You know, I think there's also a key distinction that I teach in my programs, and that is there's no such thing as time management. You know, and people say, oh, of course there is. I've taken courses on time management. Well, I can tell you, if you did, it was a waste of your money because you can't manage time. And if you don't believe me, try to stop your watch. I mean, you cannot stop time. You can't speed it up. You can't slow it down. What you can do is that you can manage your activities and you can manage your priorities. And by getting clear about what it is that's important to you, why it's important to you, and what it's going to do for you in your life and in your business and for the things that are most important to you, you can manage your priorities, you can manage your activities, and you can manage how you spend your time, but you can't manage time. So I think that is not only a key distinction, I think it's very, very important to keep in mind because it makes you more effective, makes you more successful, makes you more strategic, gives you more leverage, as you were mentioning, but also I think in the long run it makes you happier.
That's absolutely true, and it's good to use your time wisely.
Absolutely.
If you were going to share one powerful strategy, tactic, or technique, or tool for succeeding in business, what would that be?
The very first thing that I would say is that right now, it may not be the moment you get off the phone, but right now, like within the next couple of hours, I mean, sit down, take a half an hour, and think deeply about what it is that's important to your life and what it is that's important in your business. And ask yourself, is your business and the way you're spending your life and the way you're spending your time, the way you're investing your resources and the things you're doing, giving you the things that you really truly want out of your life and out of your business? You know, are you passionate about it? You know, is it serving your values? Is it consistent with your personal mission and your personal vision of who you want to become and what it is you want to contribute to the world? And if the answer is absolutely yes, ask yourself this question. How can I do it more? How can I do it better? How can I do it for more people? How can I do it longer? And how can I make sure that I do it on a more consistent basis? If the answer is no, ask yourself, what changes do you need to make, do you want to make, and are you committed to making to make sure you can get those things in alignment? Now, you may not get the answer spot on the very first time, but taking that 30 minutes or that hour or that one day of deep reflection and asking yourself and answering those questions can have a profound shift, not only in your business, but also in your life and who you are as a person and the happiness that you feel in life.
So basically, you have to reevaluate where you are in your business and take action each and every single day and align yourself with powerful mentors that's going to help you grow your bottom line.
And again, if that's what you want. I mean, you know, sometimes businesses think they have to grow because people tell them they have to grow. And I would say that all businesses have to grow somewhat because if you're not growing, you're going to stagnate. And eventually, if you stagnate, you'll start to contract. But some people, you know, they have a business where they're making a nice lifestyle. You know, they're working 40 hours a week. They're making a couple $100,000 a year. They get to take vacations with their family. They get to go see their kids' sports games, and they're perfectly happy with that. And someone says, you know what? You really need to have a $100 million business. Now, for that person who's got the lifestyle that they want, they got the income that they need, they got the business that they want, they don't need to have a couple $100 million business. And when people tell them that, it's inconsistent and incongruent with what it is that they need to do. But for someone else, if they want to grow a couple $100 million business, they might have to make different decisions or take different actions. So I would say yes, you know, having mentors is great. And yes, you know, being able to grow your business is important, but it may not necessarily be absolutely vital. But the key is having an understanding of what it is that you want from your business so that you can do the things that are necessary to make your business the way you want it.
Do you think, Spike, that you was put on this planet to teach people how to grow their business?
No, I really don't. If I were to say, you know, what I think I was put here for, it's really more about, you know, the life and the personal growth aspect of it. You know, I happen to work with business people in part because that's my expertise. But I would say one of the distinctions that I have when I work with a business and the reason why I choose to work with small to mid-sized businesses as opposed to corporations is because I like working with people. And while, you know, many people separate themselves as a business consultant or a personal growth consultant or whatever you want to call it, you know, I don't think you can separate the two because businesses are made of people and people are impacted by their businesses and their careers. I mean, so for me, it's really about working with people and not necessarily teaching people about business. I just happen to use business and business strategies as one of my areas to engage people and to interact with people and to support people through my work.
Can you explain to my listeners in your own way, Spike, how would you define God?
I'll say this, and I mean this with all respect to every religion in the world and every religion that people have. You know, to me, there's no one path to God because I think God exists in everything and everyone. And I think, you know, it really is about the interconnectedness that we all have as people and as humans and in our place in the cosmos. And I think where we are and who we are is somewhere, somehow aligned to a greater connection. And that connection could be energy, it could be God, it could be whatever term you want to use. But at the end of the day and at the end of our lives, I mean, we're all still part of the same process. And I think the same with business. And that's why, you know, when you ask me about competition and competitors, I really don't see that I have competition and competitors, because I think they're collaborators and I think they're my colleagues. And I think if we all understand our unique gifts and our unique way in terms of, you know, how we express ourselves, you know, whether it be our religion or whether it be our value to the marketplace, there's room in there for everyone and there's room in there for all of us.
I want to ask you a powerful word, and you can explain to me and my listeners in your own way how you feel about this word, wealth building.
Yeah, I think wealth building is subjective, and I'll give an example. I mean, I can't remember the person who first said it, but it's a well-known quote, and that is, you know, sometimes the wealthiest people are the people who need the least, because if you can be content with what it is that you have, you may have all the riches in the world. And yet, you know, there's some people that have billions of dollars that are perfectly miserable. So I would say wealth building is about, you know, finding the things that make you happy, that give you the most joy, give you the most satisfaction, and give you the most juice and jazz out of life. And when you have more of that, you have more wealth, whether you measure it through money, whether you measure it through possessions, whether you measure it through power, whether you measure it through contribution to a cause. And the greater you can have that alignment in your life and in your business, the wealthier you are, in my opinion.
And I love what Jim Rohn says. He says, success is attracted to those who are constantly on a growing scale. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at physics, there's nothing that's stagnant in the universe. You know, things are either contracting or they're expanding, but they're constantly in motion. There is nothing in this universe that exists that is in a still state. And if you're not growing, you are contracting. And if you're contracting, eventually, you know, you'll contract to the point where you become obsolete, at least obsolete in the field that you're pursuing right now. And for some people, you know, that's called retirement. I mean, there are a lot of people that say, you know what, I'm going to retire and I'm going to do nothing and I'm going to contract into a television set. And as long as they're happy, they're probably pretty wealthy. But if they're not happy, then they're probably doing the wrong thing. But I think growth gives you choices, because people learn through contrast. They don't learn through sameness. The bottom line is, if we have people that are telling us the same thing, they're reinforcing the things that we already know, we're not really learning anything. We're just becoming more certain about what we think we know. But at the same time, if people introduce us to new ideas, or we get exposed to new ways of thinking, or we get exposed to new ways of doing things, now we have the choice of either doing the way we were doing it before, or doing it a new way, or doing it in some combined way. So that choice comes through growth, and that growth comes through contrast and being exposed to new ideas, new people, new strategies, and new things.
What legacy do you want to leave your clients as well as your family?
I would say three things. You know, one is to create value for myself and for others, and hopefully, you know, for the world in some small way. You know, I'm not egotistical enough to think that I'm going to change the world by myself, but I like to think that if I impact someone in a positive way and I contribute something to them, then in some small way they'll contribute to someone else, and maybe part of what I shared or part of what I did will help that along the way. And the second is to treat people with respect and conduct myself with respect, meaning that, you know, not to do things that are against my conscience and not to do things that are against the well-being of other people, at least not intentionally. And then finally, I would say just, you know, to have a unique perspective and some unique value about how I see things, right, wrong, and different, whether people agree, whether they disagree, that I was, you know, true to my opinions, true to my beliefs, and true to my insights. You know, some people will like it, some people won't, and some people won't care one way or the other, but at the end of the day, that's really the three things that I would like to do, I think, most of my life.
Do you have any last pearls of wisdom for the listeners, Spike?
I would say, if I were to leave people with one thought, and that is, you know, to examine what it is that's most important to you and figure out how you can take what's most important to you and create value for other people by doing what's most important to you, will give you an opportunity not only to benefit them, but will allow you to live what's most important, do what's most important, be what's most important, and have what's most important to you in ways that you never dreamed possible if you only thought about it from the perspective of yourself.
Thank you, Spike.
Thanks, everyone.
For more great interviews like this, go to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
That's the end of this interview with Spike Humer. I hope you find it helpful. For more great interviews on business, marketing, health, copywriting, advertising, and direct mail, go to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.